Im Kunstraum, der Podcast vom Kunstraum Niederösterreich. Herzlich willkommen zur ersten Folge unseres Podcasts Im Kunstraum im neuen Jahr. Mein Name ist Katharina Brandl, ich bin die künstlerische Leitung des Kunstraum Niederösterreich und passend zur ersten Ausstellung unseres Jahres Oh, make your fingernails into space, your palms into shovels, spreche ich heute mit dem polnisch-litauischen Duo Dorota Gaweda und Ekle Kulbokaty. Ich habe die beiden einige Wochen vor dem Beginn ihrer Ausstellung im Kunstraum getroffen, um über ihre Zusammenarbeit und natürlich auch über die Ausstellung zu sprechen. Viel Spaß! Hi Dorota, hi Ekle, and welcome to our podcast.
Hello Katharina, nice to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me in your studio. I said welcome, but of course I'm also welcomed here by you, so thank you very much. And it's lovely to chat with you today. It took us a few tries because of technical problems that were my fault. But now we're sitting here and we only have a few weeks to go before we'll open your show at Kunstraum Niederösterreich. How are you doing? How are the preparations going so far? Do you have a good feeling?
Yes, we have a really good feeling. We really enjoy working with you and with all the team. And I think the works are nearing to the completion, the new ones, and the installation is going to go smoothly, I believe. So.
Yes, very exciting.
So how did you start working together? I mean, everybody can Google that you started working together in 2013, I think. But how did this evolve? How did, you know, working sporadically together become this joint practice that it is now?
So we met while during our studies. We both did an MA at the Royal College of Art in London, and this is where we met. And somehow, a little bit later after graduation, we moved to Berlin and we decided to start a reading group project. It was called the Angle Reading Group. And that was 2013.
Yes, I think that's where like our common like practice developed, through reading and text, through interest in reading and text, and mainly like feminist and queer theory. It was quite intense. Reading group open to the public for 2 years. It happened every Sunday, 7 p.m. So we were very dedicated for 2 years. And we read many interesting texts, and I think that's how we formed the core of our ideas together, through sharing the text, the same text.
So I guess even though we didn't really set out to have like an artistic collaboration, somehow it's just organically developed into one through this common pool of research and references. And I think, yeah, that's how text also found itself at the core of our work, or different forms of engaging with text.
And before that, when you met during your studies, did you practice, you know, do you see now kind of how your practice joined, also where the nodes were before in your individual practice, besides text, maybe on a level of media, that made you come together so beautifully?
I think Dorota was doing performance a lot, like before we met, and I think that's how we continued with performance as our first.
And you did and you did writing as well, so somehow maybe it was quite a natural development that this is how we started making work together as well.
Through young girl reading performances first, and then like different performance pieces, video pieces that deal with text, that will be include script writing and performative elements also. So seems like a natural progression. Yeah.
And the young girl reading group was always, back in the day also, was always public?
Yes, I mean, it was public, it was open to anyone who would like to join, but it happened in a very private space of mm-hmm. our home in Berlin, but it kind of had like an open door idea of like a Sunday afternoon, and anyone could join, and often complete strangers joined and stayed for a long time.
And came to your flat.
Yeah.
We met a lot of nice people throughout. Mm-hmm.
So the show has an unusually long title, not for you, but for us. So it's called, I'm saying that because you have longer titles than this your works. Oh, make your fingernails into spades, your palms into shovels. And it is actually a quote from a song that you wrote. And this song then became the basis for the video installation, Mouseless Part 2, which we also feature at Kunstraum Niederösterreich. It's in a way, in terms of square meters, it will be the biggest work. Projected three-channel video installation. And we're going to listen now to the part of the song that got quoted for the title.
Both light and darkness reached out your
Both.
From the earth, from the dark soil, with legs for me, can I use to lift myself? Oh, my arms to lean upon. Oh, my soul, my little heart. Oh, make your fingernails into space. Your palms into shovels. Oh, throw the soil onto one side and slab to the other. Turn your hands into shovels. Dig yourself out. Return to me.
I think everybody is wondering, how come you started a video installation with a song?
I guess like since the reading, since beginning of our practice, if we start from there, we're interested also in collective knowledge and this kind of collective thinking and this voicing of a text. So I think a song was something interesting for us to start with.
Yeah, so it's somehow like this idea of a kind of collective creativity that can happen through this type of oral tradition of singing together, polyphonic singing, is something that we really wanted to look into for a long time. So actually approaching text differently, like not in the reading group as written text, but spoken word actually. So we based the video on a tradition that is native to, I guess, several countries, but specifically we refer to Lithuanian polyphonic singing of sutartinė songs.
Yeah, I guess this polyphonic singing like allows a multiplicity of voices, which we kind of try to have in many of our works, like this difference of opinions and like layered information or layered text that we want to have in the pieces also.
And in the same time, we were really interested in how a song can give you a really different approach to an artwork that is not the intellectual kind of perception of the ideas, but more of an emotional response, I think. And that's why I think we're really interested in this type of,
Like, we always dealt with language and theoretical text, but we try to approach it in a non-hierarchical way. And, like, emotional way is for us, like, a way to approach this theoretical text in this piece particularly. Like, what we did with the lyrics of the song is, like, the way we work with, like, appropriate number of quotes from theory and, like, sci-fi and the... like poetry, and we made this amalgamation of our own that became like our own text through repetition, cutting up. And we wanted this theory to be like more accessible towards like towards the audience through this emotive and kind of voice expression, I guess. And I guess the title that you mentioned, Katarina, it's important for us because it's part of our song, but it's also part of another song that's Greek lament song. And we, for a long time, we were interested in this like lamenting tradition because of our relations to Greece and like because we did a lot of research there and like and because it's performed, this lamenting as a collective ritual by women also. So I guess like what I wanted to say that is like this title is very important on two levels also. Exhibition title, like as part of our work, but as part of a reference towards this lamenting tradition also. And the Mouthless Part 2, I guess it unfolds also as a lament, like a some kind of towards this ecological crisis also that we feel like, I guess, not we feel, we know is unfolding around us also.
And there are several protagonists in the song, which are demons and other kind of figures. Is it a narrative in the end with, you know, those vampire-like figures that appear and...
I guess it's some form of a narrative, but it's not a linear narrative. So it actually just kind of goes back and forth and loops in circles. And that's how the installation works anyways, also, I think, especially in the exhibition too. I think it's because we refer to folklore and the time of folklore, which is also cyclical. In a way, it seems like an appropriate means to maybe approach the ecological crisis and a way to approach the environment without maybe somehow separating yourself from it. Because, I mean, the way that demons and spirits of landscape function in Eastern European folklore broadly is that everyone is somehow endangered of becoming such a demon. So there is never a clear-cut separation between yourself and the other, the scary, the monstrosity that is in the landscape. So it really just goes back and forth. And there is a haunting, but it's also the fear of becoming the one who is haunting. So not only of being haunted, but it's always this kind of mutual relationship. And we find it really interesting because somehow these figures have this ability of mediating the landscape in a very different way than other representations, I think.
Yeah, I guess we've been looking a lot into history of the, how the idea of like nature as one unified construct has been created. I guess mainly with the, like this kind of Western systems, capitalistic systems, and I guess this like can provide like a alternate view of how nature can be understood in a plural way through different interfaces as well, like to have a conversation with also.
Yeah, so I think we also try to maybe convey in this video work this idea of somehow of a ritual as a kind of as a type of mediative interface between I guess in yourself and the environment, but also just different temporalities. So thinking about the past and the future and the present as somehow reoccurring in themselves constantly. And this being, in a way, nurtured by the ritual of inviting the dead and the demons back into your home, which was done in this type of Slavic tradition that maybe we refer to most directly, and it happened once a week, so it was really a constant in people's lives.
Maybe as a follow-up, of course, people are very much drawn in by the song and by the sound of the installation, but of course it's also extremely visual. How did you come when you started with the song? How did you come from the song and the words then to the images and the performance?
I guess what's important about this piece that it's performed, the voice is performed, yes, before the video is made, and actors that you would see in the video, they're not the ones that they're speaking someone else's voice. And I think this kind of speaking someone else's voice, like embodying somebody else's voice, was really important to us. So like this kind of like not matching or a glitch between the body and the voice, something that you don't expect, but also kind of convincing in a way that is shot. So the performers, they lip sync to the song, like to kind of
I mean, for us it was just really interesting to maybe just subvert this like our usual way of thinking about making of a video, just the image comes first and then the sound is always somehow secondary to that. So we really wanted to reverse it and think about the sound first and then create the images around this sound. And this is also how the performers approach it. Mm-hmm. They are acting out what's they're hearing and not the other way around somehow. So we kind of really like to give the song like the most important place here, I think.
Yeah, and it becomes like this kind of idea, possibility of like giving voice to like to the dead or to the environment, like possibility of like someone else speaking through you. Like
yeah, it's like a type of haunting that they kind of imagine themselves going through also, I think, in their performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And you already said that you also see the song in this lamenting or lament tradition. And that it's about also commemorating or lamenting nature. And there are many, many landscapes at Kunstraum Niederösterreich. So maybe we move on to the landscapes because that's super interesting. So we have objects that, you know, kind of open up a 3D-dimensional landscape at Kunstraum. So we have a haystack. That's a little bit intimidating. And we have an object that is similar to a rake at Kunstraum. So they're like quotes of agricultural references. And then we have artificial landscapes in the video, but also in the glass window that were generated by artificial intelligence. So it seems to be a big topic. Maybe you could
give us a little intro. And also, I mean, I guess that's a big question for you. How do you even represent something like landscape in the Anthropocene?
I guess that's why I think whenever something resembles the landscape quite directly, something that we recognize as landscape, it could be a painting, but actually it's not a painting. It's a synthetically produced image. So it's generated by an algorithm. And I think we really didn't want to have this direct framed representation of a landscape that we would somehow create. And it was interesting for us to think of this type of representation as a technology always, not only when an algorithm makes it, but also historically when an artist makes it, because it's just this moment of somehow separating yourself and framing the other, which is nature, that happens there. So I think it was really interesting for us just to give off this to literally like a machine that would try to do that, just as artists have done that in the past. And
but you're talking about the background now from the video.
Yes.
And how did you do that?
So basically it's an open source algorithm that through a type of pattern recognition creates an infinite possible amounts of images, variations of a given topic, I guess. And it really tries to produce this kind of idea of like perfect nature with like mountains and rivers and something quite romantic and foggy. So it's somehow interesting how it does what we crave also.
So the images that Dorota is speaking about appears as an animated material in the video, Mouthless Part 1. But these kind of gun animations and imagery also appear in our work, Death by Landscape. That's a sculptural work that like is a stained glass window piece. I think that you will see like once you come in into the space. And there, like this animation becomes like a kind of constant amalgamation of like kind of organic looking creatures, and it becomes like a kind of game of like pattern recognition in some way, because like the material that we have like printed on the glass is quite abstract, but there's two levels of recognizing this organic life through this algorithmic imagery and through like human cognition, I guess, like making out like images in this abstraction also by the audience as well.
Yeah, and the title of the glass window of Death by Landscape Fribourg is also for me it was a super interesting reference that you opened up to me. So it is this short story by Margaret Atwood that we all know from The Handmaid's Tale, as the author of The Handmaid's Tale. And the short story was extremely fascinating, and it was such a good story. And I think you're referring also directly to it in a way with the title.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful story, and we also read it in the as part of Young Girl Reading Group like a few years ago, and really stuck with us somehow, like written like in a very like kind of a simple like narrative way. It really touches you in this way that like the main character loses her friend as a child in the forest, in the woods. And like what she has left is this imagination that her friend became part of the landscape, and this kind of idea, the fear of like disappearing into the landscape also, that somehow relates to grief, I guess, as well, because she's missing her. But there is also mystery and haunting because she doesn't know where she is, I guess, and like what happened to her.
And she also has a set of she has a collection of paintings in her house, and she's always looking for her missing friend in these paintings. And she's always taking on different forms. So somehow for us it was just, I guess, also this like kind of strange tension between this this grief, but also a type of game that you keep on playing with your friend that's gone. So somehow, yeah, I feel like this kind of maybe what we were thinking about with this piece, no?
Yeah, and I guess like the sculpture has a window shaped, and it's like in a way like also framing the natural also from like a constructed environment, like. Mm. So this like is a suggestion, I guess, mm-hmm. like the form of it.
The looking out part, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I found super interesting about it also was, and I had to think about that a lot regarding the works that we will show, is this question of giving agency back to the landscape, which is not the nature, which is not nature itself. Mm. It is like the human constructed version of nature in a way. And as you said before, Dorota, this idea of landscape painting, and then very explicitly also shown in romantic landscape painting, where you actually see this one man, the back of the one man, which whom you should associate yourself with, and then you know you see it more or less from the standpoint of this one painted figure, and it's so explicit that this is man or human, but actually man made nature in a way, and. Yeah, it's dominated by men. And the idea of giving agency back, because you don't know, well, Lucy doesn't know where her friend is, and the landscape is looking back at her. And that's the minimum of agency, is that she's kind of unsure what this landscape also in the image is doing. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's also a beautiful part of the story as well, is giving agency also. I guess in a way, like, in some ways, like this, like, because when you think like this hexagonal sculpture that could do like with the haystack, with this sharpened, like, kind of shiny pole, that like it's somehow terrifying, and it's maybe in this way looking towards you as well, I guess. I mean, in the other works that we have in the exhibition, we also kind of try to address the same ideas. And also this kind of, like, this beginning of the understanding of the natural as something, like, of a property also, as a land to be contained or, like, to work on, like, privatized. And
become, like, productive also, I guess.
Mm. So it continues through, I think most of the works as well in this exhibition. Mm-hmm.
Another very general question. So as you described before, what brought you in a way in your practice together was working with text. And I think what is so great about your work is also that it's, of course, it's very, there are so many references to literature, to theory, and so on, but you never, it never gets to the point where one feels that you're visualizing something. Do you have specific methods that you use that there is this kind of making of a distance and not becoming too literal in a way? And
I think like we're always trying to make it more simple. I think we had like troubles with literal, like it's process of like kind of condensing your thoughts so it speaks through form also, like in more visual ways also, something that we want to say, what we want to convey. Because I guess like we always like want to share the ideas that like we have and the readings that we have, but it, like, I guess, like, sculpture needs different access for people, needs more visual or, like, bodily kind of way to relate to the audience.
But I also think because we think of so many references in one time, it can never really become an illustration because there's simply too many references in one. And
they speak to each other, I guess.
Also. They speak to each other, at least for us, hopefully for the audience as well. But I guess that's just, even though we do look into text so much, we somehow try not to have like a hierarchy of importance of these textual references that we use. So I mean, it's equally important for us to have a quote from a folk song and some theoretical quotes. So I don't think we, maybe this is somehow what helps us, I think, with not sticking to maybe one idea so closely and in such a like illustrative way.
Yeah, and I guess like in the same way like about experience, because like we try to like the audience to be able to experience work on different dimensions, not only like visual or textual, but it could be a smell also. For example, Hexanol, with this like collection of hay, like provides like insights, a lot of memories, I guess, in the audience members, like as far as we hear from the people that we talk to. So I think this is another like layer that's important for us, like also the communication through different senses as well. Yeah.
Should we play a little game before we come to the last question?
<Let's do it>.
Katarina didn't tell us what it's going to be.
I already wanted to ask if you peeked at my...
No, we were fair.
Okay, so it's a very easy game in a way, because you know each other for such a long time. So I thought I could ask you a few questions in the sense of who is most likely to blah, 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 blah.
Who needs to answer first or at the same time?
Same time.
Okay. Who is most likely of the both of you to meet a ghost?
Me.
Yeah, I agree.
That was easy.
Yeah.
That was too easy almost.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Okay, that's obvious.
Yeah, that's
no,
obvious.
No explanation needed. No. Who is most likely to be in a choir?
Dorota probably also.
Actually, neither.
Probably neither.
Yeah. Really, neither, I think.
No, we on the music part, we really like, we have a really nice, beautiful collaborations, and this is the part that we really trust other people to work on also.
I think the song was really like the way we recorded it. It was a workshop, and it was really somehow led by the singers and the person who helped us with the recording. So
I mean,
we kind of really give a lot of the agency also to the people who work with us, I think. Choir is not our thing personally.
We know some people in the choir, but
it would be so funny if the answer is always the rota, and then in the end it's just alright.
Can expand it. She is just very likely to do things. So.
So who would most likely dye her hair red?
Egla.
Yeah, more likely me, because I always change it. It could happen.
Who would most likely sleepwalk?
Me.
Yeah, would I imagine?
Did it happen before?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's also a way of being in between the worlds, although you're not really, but then again.
I mean, I think people do it a lot when they're kids and teenagers, and I did it a lot when I was like kind of growing up. Since I'm not sure if I have done it many times, but I think it happens sometimes, yeah.
And did you really wake up in, I don't know, the kitchen or something?
Yeah, actually once I left the house. So I had this kind of, I didn't wake up, but I had a dream of it. And then I was told the next day that I went outside. So this was really crazy.
What did you do?
What did I do?
Yeah.
I just wanted to leave the house.
Did you want to do something specific?
This I don't know what the intention was, but I just really wanted to leave the house.
I don't know. I have this silly phobia from my childhood, because I watched this American TV show where they said that like that like some people, at least in America, United States, I mean, they would sleepwalk and kill other people while sleepwalking. And as a child, I got so terrified that this could happen to me, that I could like fall asleep and murder someone not knowing me, that I'm still so terrified. It was really terrifying.
I still don't know what my intention was. No idea.
Hopefully they don't want to murder you.
But it's also so specific,
it really affects
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It really affects the child, though. Like, if you're really small and you see something like this, so terrifying.
But it's, I mean, it's also the absolute loss of control in a way, to be sleeping and doing something, and you're still doing it, but you aren't, and
And then you would be judged, I guess, obviously, according to non-sleeping rules. It's a horrible situation.
Who is most likely to hold their breath the longest? Or the longest as possible?
I think
me also.
Yeah.
You only have red hair on this list.
It's fine.
Okay, another weird one. Who is most likely to be the first one to die in a zombie apocalypse?
I think Egla.
Why? No, I don't agree.
Because you're a bit clumsy. I mean, I will try to save you.
But?
But I don't know. Maybe I will become a zombie first and then you're just finished.
I don't know. We will see, I guess. We will see.
And I feel like the last question is answered already. It would have been, who is most likely to get a heart attack from watching a horror movie? Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I really think it's me.
I wouldn't.
No.
I thought because the story of murdering in your sleep.
I think it was a child. Okay. I think by now I'm a bit less sensitive.
Yeah, I think I get more scared actually when we watch horror movies.
Yeah, I'm also really bad at this. Jump scares are the worst. Like, it really feels like my heart
sometimes
might stop.
Because we really like horror movies. But sometimes we watch them during the day or, like, early morning.
just not to get too scared.
Thank you for playing along.
It's a fun game. The answer was Dorota. The correct answer.
Very good. So maybe to finish our podcast off, as you know, the topic of this year's annual program is stages of grief. And of course, we talked about Mouseless Part 2, referring to laments. How do you feel about, you know, our current situation and what we're grieving or what we might be grieving and how, you know, our show can relate to that?
I guess like what's interesting for me is like now a lot of writing, like when you read about grief and you try to like understand more about it, like there is only very narrow field that deals with a collective grief, I think. And I think that's why it's for us it's interesting to think about it and propose it as a like idea of a collective grief. And I think I guess like also like this work, I guess, is like also like a possibility for us to try to understand what like one feels, also on like to kind of create a more like constructive maybe experience through the work also, and like like while we like while you move past the emotional stage of it, like maybe there could be like some kind of like directed like move or like activity that can, I don't know, be formed after also.
Yeah, because somehow like this lamenting tradition is really interesting for us because it really serves a function in the society, and it really like somehow because it makes this grieving collective, it somehow maybe also kind of generates a possibility of the future after this, and maybe in this way somehow we see it as as a method also to deal with something that seems so vast and also that touches everyone in an equal way, but also no one really knows how to how to approach it on the other hand.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me in your studio and bringing all of that equipment. And we're very much looking forward on, you know, installing the show, opening the show. And of course, for our listeners, that's already in the past. But of course, they all knew that we were very much excited in the weeks running up to it. Yeah. So thank you very much. And yeah. Let's install the show.
We'll see you soon, everyone. Yes.
Herzlichen Dank fürs Zuhören. Wie immer folgen Sie uns gerne auf unseren Social-Media-Kanälen oder abonnieren Sie unseren Newsletter. Bis bald und auf Wiederhören.